Picasso, however, was very well known in the Spanish community even before he made that first trip to Paris. So much so that one of his works, Les Moulins de la Galette, was on display in the Spanish Pavilion at the World Expo. The gouache, called a group of women, was most probably realized in Paris in the autumn of 1901. In the background, there are prostitutes from the Women's Prison Hospital of Saint-Lazare in Rue du Faubourg Saint-Denis. A former convent and a leper colony, in Picasso's time, the hospital was divided into two sections, one for condemned women and the other for prostitutes, with the two distinguished from the other by the color of their hats. Picasso became acquainted with the Institute's director, Dr. Louis Julien, and was able to visit the facility with the help of a collector. His interest in outcasts was shared by his Catalan friends. With Carles, Joaquim, Frederic, and the others, Pablo shared houses, models, studios, food, and boozy nights. But when he returned to Paris the following year for his second trip, on the occasion of an exhibition commissioned by the dealer Vollard, he would be the guest for 10 months of his art dealer Permanac at 130 Terre of Boulevard de Clichy. Pablo was by now more determined than ever to conquer Paris, but it was a struggle. Accounts of the time reveal a youth forced to work on a canvas placed on a bench lower than the easel, bent over to crouch over it. Yet he executed more than 60 works on cardboard in record time. He painted, ate little, and frequently went out in the evenings. The police kept an eye on him. Picasso certainly felt foreign, but at the same time, he understood that the city could be opened up thanks to his talent. He frequented exhibitions and galleries, absorbing the lesson of the Pre-Raphaelites, and it was also in that year that he experienced profound grief following the death of his dear friend Casagemas. He painted a portrait of the artist on his deathbed. It was a violent death, which came about after an argument between Carles and a model, Laure Gargallo, known as Germaine, a woman who was married. Carles handed her a packet of letters, then attempted to shoot her. He missed, but the artist turned the gun on himself and died. The details of the tragedy were in the reports of the police, which had been keeping an eye on the painter for some time. And in 1901 came the first report on Pablo. Commissioner Rouquier, in charge of public order in the Montmartre district, drew up a Picasso file that would forever mark the artist's destiny in France. Other reports arrived, often based on rumors and gossip. The Catalans were called anarchists, dissolute, vice-ridden. In a word, dangerous. But Picasso continued to work, and on his third trip to Paris between 1902 and 1903, he faced his most painful and difficult period. Little money, dirty rooms, cheap food. It was now that his research into the world of the slums developed. He painted the poor, the prostitutes, the desolate scenes of outlying districts in Paris, which engraved themselves in his sensitivity. The colors took on a symbolic significance. While with the portrait of the dead Casagemas he began to take an interest in blue shades, the cutter of heads, which dates from this period, gives us an almost violent vigour with touches of blood red here and there. There is a story behind this gouache. In the spring of 1901, Picasso spent a few days in Barcelona, where he was again searching out that forgotten humanity he had seen in Paris. He produced drawings depicting assassins or executioners, presences that never actually display their merciless action, which is left to the viewer's imagination. In this drawing, a figure is armed with a knife, still dripping with the blood of his victims, whose heads are lined up in the background, forming a banner. There is an obvious reference to the macabre literature of the time. For example, the French Gaston Leroux, who would write a noir book called Une Petite Tête a year later. But at the same time, a trait appears in this drawing that would also accompany Picasso in his future developments, representing a new bud in his multifaceted genius. Despite the macabre tone, the contrast between the red, ochre, and grey gives the group a grotesque, almost caricatured appearance, as if it were an illustration of a horror novel. And this dichotomy between the sublime and the grotesque would also be one of the keys to Picasso's work when, in Guernica, he takes up the subjects of the tauromachy, or bullfight. Years later, Picasso noted, "I started painting in blue when I understood that Casagemas had died." Group of men and the melancholic portrait of a man are emblems of a sorrowful humanity that does not escape the attention of the police. So un-French, thought the authorities, so prone to negative feelings. There is a pictorial shift in this blue, melancholic man. In the winter between 1902 and 1903, Picasso put aside the female universe that had inspired him for the women of Saint-Lazare. Male figures emerge with a moral despair inexorably tinged with blue, a characteristic that runs through the works between the end of 1901 and 1904. In this portrait, there's a man with hollow cheeks, sad eyes, and crossed arms, a gesture found in other male paintings of the same period. When Pierre D asked him about the model for this painting, which he kept in his studio and which he had left unfinished, Picasso said that he was a madman you could see in the street. Everyone knew him in Barcelona, confusing the trail as to the precise circumstances of his creation. Although the identity of this man is uncertain, he belongs to the large family of desperate people the artist met in the working-class neighborhoods of Paris and in Barcelona's Barrio Quino, just one of those figures peopling the so-called Blue Period. Meanwhile, however, new friendships developed in his life. Maxime Jacob, for instance, who shared a flat with him and taught him the rudiments of the French language. A Breton Jewish poet and homosexual, Jacob later converted to Catholicism and chose Picasso as his godfather. They shared a bed, or rather took turns in it. Max at night, Pablo during the day. Max even painted a portrait of Picasso in pencil and pen on paper. And then Guillaume Apollinaire appeared, barely a year older and a foreigner like himself, born in Rome to an unknown father and a fallen Polish aristocrat. A poet and a magician of words, he was a very important presence for Picasso, who was always looking for new forms of expression. Apollinaire would say of him that he was the greatest artist who ever existed, after Michelangelo, and together they would experiment with blending poetry, painting, and drawing. Picasso often drew him in jacket and hat, with a pipe, with a dog on a leash. And, little by little, Picasso broke away from the Catalan colony. On his fourth and definitive arrival in Paris in 1904, he went to live at 13 Rue Ravignan in Montmartre. The era of the bateau lavoir began. In the Grande Carrière neighborhood, Picasso found accommodation in the studio of his Barcelona friend, Paco Durrío, in a building that Max Jacob nicknamed Bateau Lavoir because of its precarious construction and dilapidated structure. It was an old factory that the owner, at the end of the 19th century, wished to convert into an apartment block containing a dozen or so homes, taking advantage of the demand for houses that New Paris was experiencing. The spaces were divided up as best as possible, but there was only one water supply point and sanitary facilities were almost non-existent. For 5 years, from the 1st of April 1904 to the 1st of September 1909, this was to be Picasso's domicile as he joined a community of artists. And in his life there was a woman, one of the very few who would remain close to him forever, Maria, his mother. She wrote up to 4 letters a week to her son, one every 2 days or so, sometimes even one a day, depending on the period, but without interruption between 1904 and 1938, the year of her death, when the artist himself was almost 60 years old. Many sentiments are discernible in the mother's letters, from apprehension about her son's living conditions to a great fragility, that of a woman in need of care and closeness. "Dear Pablo, my son," writes Maria Ruiz in one of the letters, "I only ask you to tell me if I can count on you if I need anything, like all mothers who have a child." Picasso answered when he was able, but he was often too busy painting. Almost unconcerned about the slum he shared with Fernande Olivier, it is here that he would paint the famous series of acrobats, and it is here that he applied the first brush strokes for Demoiselles d'Avignon, the active birth of Cubism. And so, little by little, Pablo changed his point of view. He moved from the poor of the slums to a new model of outcast humanity, that of the circus nomads, the homeless acrobats, the clowns. From 1904 to 1905, he depicted this swarm of colorful and sad characters, represented in a scenic yet thoughtful manner. He sought out the circus. He went to see the Medrano in Montmartre and the Cirque d'Hiver in Boulevard de Fil du Calvaire. But in depicting them, he departed from the models he had behind him, from Watteau to Degas. Picasso favored the offstage, the behind the scenes, immortalizing them in the moments beyond the circus ring. And once again, the grotesque, or rather the comic, goes hand in hand with the tragic quality of these figures, who, without their masks, are outcasts like the friends of his early Parisian years. The beautiful La Famille de Saltimbanque, which arrives from the National Gallery in Washington, echoes a poem that his friend Apollinaire had given him. "The strollers in the plain walk the length of gardens." In these figures that are both integrated into the landscape and out of place, because they are far from the circus, there is a Picasso reflecting on the use of color, experimenting with softer shades. And when, years later, the poet Rainer Maria Rilke saw the painting in Hertha König's living room, he, in turn, composed a poem dedicated to the circus people.